We are not going.
Ready?
We will convene the, at this juncture, subcommittee of the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee
for Monday, April 19th. We are opening our hearings on House Bill 5055, the Oregon Youth Authority. I think we'll hear from several in the department today, but let's start off with Sheila Baker, the Legislative Fiscal Office Representative, and hear a staff report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. The Oregon Youth Authority is the budget that will be before you now and probably through at least next week. Let me go through the various papers and stuff that are before you. The first thing I wanted to point out is you have an envelope from the Secretary of State that follow-up information, their closing comments that they did not have time to give to you when you were hearing from them on the Department of Correction audit. So you have them in writing now from the Secretary of State. There is another handout that is a follow-up from information that was presented in the Ways and Means overview on cost per day for Oregon Youth Authority beds and for Department of Correction beds. The handout looks like this. We're not covering that specifically today. We may get into that in the OIA testimony, but the information that you had not had previously and that Larry Newslander has presented now from Department of Corrections concerns their cost per bed day. And then the last page of that is the budgeted cost per day per inmate by institution for Department of Corrections. So that's for your review as you go through the OIA budget and then the Department of Corrections. Then I wanted to just walk you briefly through the packet of materials that I handed out. It has a clip on the top of it, includes some Secretary of State audits. There is a tentative schedule for the next 2 weeks under my cover memo there, and I just wanted to emphasize that this schedule is fluid. We do have a field trip scheduled for tomorrow. So far, two members have called me about being unable to attend, and I would urge you, if you're not going to be there, to make sure that you give me a call. And for those that are going, we'll meet at 12:30 in front of the Capitol building. Either bring your lunch or have your lunch beforehand because the OIA budget does not allow free lunches for all legislative members and staff.
I believe the term is working lunch.
Okay, working lunches. And then on Wednesday, at this point, there are two work sessions for other agencies scheduled depending on if you do both of those work sessions. The OIA budget discussion would be then postponed. If you only do one of those work sessions, we may have some time for OIA on Wednesday. And then into next week, on Monday the 26th, we'll be hearing from John Latimer and his staff to cover the juvenile justice system review audit that was required by Senate Bill 1. So they will make a presentation on that. And then Steve Marks of the Governor's Office and others will be here to talk about the Governor's Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership. There are pieces of that in this budget and then in the Criminal Justice Commission budget, which you'll hear later. Tuesday the 27th is scheduled, we expect to schedule public testimony on Oregon Youth Authority budget. And then Wednesday and Thursday we'll continue anything that we hadn't had time to present yet and then wrap up the budget. So that's the, again, tentative schedule. I've also, for your review, enclosed a copy of our Legislative Fiscal Office summary of this budget that was done in December when the governor's budget first came out. I will note that the governor now has a revised budget recommendation for the agency and the Department of Administrative Services and the agency will be discussing that as we go through this. Then there are copies of the three audits that have been done by the Secretary of State. One of which is the one that they will talk about next Monday on juvenile justice system review. But they also completed audits on the security and safety at the youth correctional facilities and the education and treatment program. So those are there if you want to get into depth and read those whole audits. The agency has also included the executive summaries and their response to them in their budget presentation document. So you have the short form version there and that we can refer to as that comes up. The agency had one budget note that I want to call to your attention. This was on the juvenile justice information system, which you've gotten information on. In 1997, there was a $1.9 million special purpose appropriation made that the agency had to come in and get to pursue their work on that system. And that release of funding was contingent upon a report saying, you know, who was playing with the system, who was going to participate with the state on this. They came in and made that report. You've heard about the juvenile justice information system. Some things have changed since that interim report in terms of county participation, Multnomah County being the primary example. But I think that you've heard information on that, and as that issue comes up from a budget standpoint, we'll have a little bit more discussion on that.
Sheila, let me interrupt you there and adjourn sub of the sub and convene the full Waiving and Public Safety Subcommittee.
Continuing on for the full committee then, the other significant interim issues for this agency included their suicide prevention improvement plan, which they developed during the interim as a result of some suicides at their institutions and an independent review team study. There was a defeat tent demonstration project that was set up in the last legislature that is now moving forward. And the issue of equal access to services between genders continues to be of interest to this agency and some other state agencies. So that basically summarizes what is in your packet here. The agency will be working mainly from this document, I believe, during their overview to you, the one, the picture of the youth on the front as opposed to the suicide document. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if there's any.
Good questions? No questions? Next item is the director's overview. Next item is agency overview, retail director. Karen, I guess you're up there too, and Burrell, who wants to come. Bill McGee from Dallas. Thank you, Sheila.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Rick Hill. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And to my left is Karen Brazeau, the deputy director. Behind us, we have additional administrative staff who helped put this budget together and will be participating in the presentation as the weeks go by. I want to spend a moment to just sort of orient you to the book that we're going to be using. You have two books. One is the larger book with the green cover. It's not the one we're going to be presenting from. The other one, with the picture of the youth on the front, is our presentation document, and that's the one we'll be using. It is organized into tab sections and also has an appendix, and I can just walk you through how this works by turning the first page past the picture. You will see that the document has a table of contents. It has six parts, the agency overview, which we'll be doing today, a section on facilities, community programs, administration, capital, budgeting, and then the appendix. And if you turn back to the appendix, you'll see that it's divided, that also has a table of contents for your convenience. And if you turn to the first tab under the appendix, tab number one, you'll see how this works. You'll see a page on acronyms. So I want to make sure everyone can follow this format, but also understand that we sometimes talk acronyms in this business, and we'll try not to for the next 2 weeks, but if we slip up and you don't feel that you want to interrupt us, which should be perfectly fine, you can flip to the first tab on your appendix and find out what the acronym stands for. You can see there are quite a few of them in this business.
These representing butlers, it's a dollar. Penny, do you use the acronym and do not define it?
That's not that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you change acronyms from what numbers you know, like FF, for me it's Floyd Frank, not federal funds.
And I do have one quick question. I always thought GED was general equivalency degree, but I think it's general education diploma. Has it been that way for a long time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, it's my understanding that GED is actually started by the Department of Defense. It started by the Army, and what it used to mean for me was general education development, not diploma. But it's, I've seen it many different ways over the years. But I think we all understand what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'd like to begin then with the overview, and that's what is listed as page one, where it says agency overview mission. The Oregon Youth Authority is the state agency that manages the state's most delinquent and difficult youth. We do this by operating and contracting for a continuum of services, and these services include institutions, camps, residential, and community programs.
Everybody got the right page. I had a problem, so that seems everybody else had a problem.
Okay, three, four, circles.
Okay.
Our mission, as described on page one, is to protect the public by holding youth accountable and providing opportunities for reformation. We're also heavily involved in and supportive of juvenile crime prevention, especially the high-risk juvenile crime prevention strategy that you'll hear about next Monday from Steve Marks and others who have been working on that plan for over 2 years. This mission calls for a balance of the four key values that define a comprehensive juvenile justice system: public safety, accountability, reformation, and prevention. To meet the public's and the victim's need for safety, we operate secure facilities, much like the Department of Corrections does. But to meet our responsibility for reformation, we manage a variety of treatment programs within our facilities throughout our network of community-based programs. The Oregon Youth Authority became a separate agency on January 1 of 1996. Since our inception, we have focused mainly on the public safety elements of that mission statement. We've constructed and opened and are now operating five new regional secure facilities around the state, as well as two youth accountability camps or boot camps. This doubling of our beds was required to make up for 10 years of capacity for juveniles and to accommodate the Measure 11 sentences. The overarching theme of our 99-01 budget is this: without neglecting our public safety mandate, we must now shift our focus toward reformation, accountability, and prevention in order to achieve the balance in our mission. So moving on to page two then in the book, over the next several days, you'll hear about some of our accomplishments, some of our challenges, and our goals. You'll hear many references to our new regional facilities, and you'll get to tour one of them tomorrow, the Oak Creek facility in Albany. You'll hear repeated mention of the JJIS system, or JJIS system, from Karen and from the juvenile directors who will be here next week to testify during the day of public testimony. You'll hear about our new young women's transition program in Corvallis, our major new effort to meet the unique treatment needs of female offenders, and that will also be on the tour tomorrow. You'll hear about our new statewide recidivism report that has all 36 counties and the state of Oregon using the same definition and the same measurements for recidivism. We believe we're the first state in the nation to accomplish that. We'll talk about the greatest challenges that we have faced and are still facing as a new agency, such as dealing with the aftermath of the tragic suicide at Hillcrest last year, and applying the resources given to us by the emergency board during the interim. You'll hear about our challenge of trying to follow the recommendations from the three-part Secretary of State's audit, how that audit confirmed the wisdom of our decision to become the national pilot state for the adoption of performance-based standards within juvenile institutions. With these challenges before us, we have set four primary goals for ourselves for this next biennium. First, to complete the development and the implementation of the JJIS system. Secondly, to implement the improvement plan that will result from the performance-based standards review. Third, to lower our recidivism through reformation and accountability programming. And fourth, to complete the construction of the Eastern Oregon Youth Accountability Camp, the last piece of our construction project, which has been sited in Union County near the community of Hilgard outside of LaGrange. So turning now to page three.
Rick, let me interrupt you there and ask the committee administrator. Appendix and size got in here once earlier today and then left, and then Karen left and came back in, and I'd be back in. Do I get two marks?
Chair's prerogative.
Yes.
Excuse us, Mr. Hill.
Hotly contested battle.
Please proceed. One way to explain what we do in the simplest of terms is to display our services and sanctions in case management or continuum. So I'm going to go over to the board and I'm going to turn this microphone over here. Most people associate the Oregon Youth Authority with the facilities we operate, McLaren Hill Press, the new regional facilities, the camps. But actually, as you can see, we have much more than that in our agency. The institutions are perhaps the centerpiece, but we have community resources on both the front end of the probation side and the back end, the parole side. Probation referring to youth who have not yet entered the institution, parole referring to those youth who are transitioning out of the institution. Oftentimes, we get a youth committed from the courts, from the local juvenile department, that only needs an out-of-home resource. He's being supervised by the county juvenile department, but he needs an out-of-home resource, and that's where the youth authority comes in. So often we get a youth just for placement into a foster home, where there's a structured living situation, or a residential treatment program where there's 24-hour supervision and a much more in-depth kind of program. And sometimes that's all it takes. The kids then, after 6 or 8 months or a year of that, can go back home again, and we'll continue to supervise them at home. Although sometimes when that happens, the youth will go back to court and get terminated or be supervised back by the county juvenile department. So that's sort of the front end of our system. And you can see we've got over 1,000 youth in that part of what we do. On the other end, coming out of the institution, we have the same basic services. We have foster care, we have residential treatment, and then we have supervision at home. Again, if the youth completes the institution, he can transition out gradually into a less and less of a secure situation, a structured situation, so finally gets back home again. Throughout all of these services, we also have individualized services or wraparound services that we can use to enhance a youth program, whether it's an alcohol and drug class or whether it's tuition or a community college program or bus tickets or something to keep them successful and keep them active in the community. And no matter where they are in our system, they are supervised by a parole and probation officer. From day one, they get that parole officer assigned, and that officer manages this case throughout the entire time he's with us in the Oregon Youth Authority. County juvenile departments have many, many more cases than we do. We have about 2,800 to 3,000 youths on any given day in our custody. County level, they're up to at least 15,000, perhaps more. Most of the kids that come in, most of the kids that break the law only break the law once or twice, and the sanctions delivered at the county level are adequate to turn their kid around, and the system never sees them again. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the recidivism study.
Senator Jim, will this include, how does Level 7 play into this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tim, Level 7 money, or the youth investment money, is administered by the Commission on Children and Families to the county. Each county spends it differently according to their local comprehensive plan. Some of it is going to offenders. Some of it is going to programs that are purely prevention programs for youth who have not yet committed crimes or not yet in the juvenile justice system.
Where does that break-off thing into this into the foster care, probation, residential treatments. Aren't these before they go into the youth authority until they are incarcerated, which level 7 is right before incarceration too, right?
And some of the level 7 money is spent by the county juvenile departments. Some of it can be used for things like shelter care or other home-based sanctions, but it is not used for kids in the Oregon Youth Authority.
Senator Tim, Karen Bruzzaro, Deputy Director. Example would be status offenders, youth who run away, for example. That doesn't rise to the level of delinquency to get into the state system, but the communities may be using those funds to try to intervene with that level of youth or youth who just have acting out behaviors.
It's a very fine edge, though, that we're at right there, right?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
It's obvious that since most of the kids that we deal with at the Youth Authority have already been dealt with at the county level, it's important for us to have good, strong partnerships with counties. So if you turn to page 4, you'll see a map of Oregon divided into the 5 regions around the state, and this is how we are organized. We're organized into 5 regions. The shaded areas indicate that 32 of the 36 counties now have a signed co-management agreement with the Oregon Youth Authority, wherein we share decision-making. Because all the kids came from these counties, we value their opinion, we value the work that they've done, and we don't want to duplicate what's already been done. So we sit down with them on a case-by-case basis and discuss these youth. Through co-management, we are planning for the best use of state and county resources. We designate how resources will be shared between the state and the county. We share decision-making about individual youth, where they go, when they come out, what services they need. And through that process, we're also able to identify the service gaps or the resource gaps in a particular county or a particular region. You'll hear more about co-management next Tuesday when some of the juvenile directors come and talk during public testimony. And in appendix number 7, you'll see sort of an elaboration of our partnerships with counties. We work very hard at getting all counties to engage us in the co-management process.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hanna, what is the different colors in the Oregon map on page 4? Like you have... one of them called, well, let's take Jackson, Josephine, Douglas, Coon, and Curry. So, Columbus and another one. Does that mean there's a facility in that section?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, the map on page 4 indicates that the shaded counties are counties we have a co-management agreement with, a written agreement. The counties like Jackson and Klamath that are not shaded, we do not have a written agreement with those counties.
So they maintain their own children or young people?
It simply means that they have not signed a written partnership agreement with us on co-management. So we still get along with them okay. It's just that we're not there yet. We don't have that degree of cooperation.
Okay.
If you look at the appendix number 7, behind tab number 7, you will see that there are actually 4 areas that we endeavor to get counties to cooperate with. One of them is the co-management agreement, and that's the one I just talked about. We are only missing Jackson, Klamath, Lincoln, Marion. That's it. We also have other areas of cooperation, including the JAGIS program and the diversion agreement. So we've got most counties participating in everything. We've got some counties that are not quite there.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can. So, like in Jackson County here, it shows no co-management agreement. You have the regional CAP agreement. Is that the cap on the amount of young people in the facility?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, what that means is that counties in that region can now share their numbers so that if Jackson County is 2 over its cap on any given day because maybe they had three or four kids do a violent crime, they wouldn't necessarily be penalized if the other counties in that region had enough space in with from their cap. So by regionalizing the cap concept, we've been able to keep everybody under the allocated bed space. So it's some flexibility we've given for them.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I think we are working on such an agreement with Jackson County. It just has all the details haven't been worked out. And those agreements are around things like care, what level of aftercare will be used in our communities for various kids. Because we have kids moving out of our institutions into those communities, as well as the juvenile departments themselves needing resources in those communities. So we try to work together about how we'll collectively use those resources.
Thank you. Representative Nitt.
Forgive me for not being here a few minutes earlier. You are the first agency that has taken the trouble to do the acronym work. It made my day. Thank you very much. It's very, very helpful for us. For helping.
And we'll try not to use them.
Yeah. Well, this is very helpful.
And something else along the same lines, Rick, Karen, whomever, that graphic, that physical representation of the agency and how and what you do is the best one I've ever seen. So, hats off and kudos.
Thank you.
Probably served it to me five times before. I just, you know, didn't figure it out. So. But no, that's a great referral of what you guys do and how you do it.
On page five, Mr. Chair, we have our agency's organizational chart, and we are not organized into divisions like a lot of other agencies are. We do not have a division of institutions, division of classification, division of parole. We are rather organized into regions, and we find that this regional organization system allows us to better meet the unique needs of the different parts of Oregon. Follow this chart down the lower left-hand corner of the Northwest area box. You will see that in that box there is a YCF, or a Youth Corrections Facility, a YAC, which is a Youth Accountability Camp, and a Work-Study Camp, along with assessment, receiving, residential care, foster care, parole, probation, all the things this agency does or purchases is managed by that regional manager, or as we call them, area coordinators. So we don't have everything being managed from central. We have these programs being managed in the community. Because the needs of the kids from the northwest corner of the state may be distinctly different from the needs of the kids in Multnomah County or in eastern Oregon or in southern Oregon. We also take into account in these different regions what county resources are in place. Multnomah, for example, has a 166-bed detention center. There wasn't a detention center in the northwest corner of the state until we built one there in our youth corrections facility. So, again, this is part of the evolution of working together, forming partnerships, co-management, helps us to organize this way. It also keeps our administration at the central level to a minimum and gives us a relatively flat organizational table. We do have a business services office, and we do have a program office. That the business services office, which you'll hear about later in the week, does the accounting and the personnel and the information systems, et cetera. The program office helps us monitor our contracts, keep our private providers under review. We have support for parole and probation department. We have a training academy. We have other things like that that are spread all over the whole agency. Moving ahead to page six, there are several key forces that impact our population and in turn drive our budget. And the first of those is the number of youth who are arrested in Oregon in a given year. Now, this chart is from the Oregon State Police. It's from the LED, from the LED system. It is a collection of all the juvenile arrests by all of the law enforcement agencies in Oregon, local, state, county, and municipal level. The good news is that the numbers are going down. The grand total shows a 4.2% decrease from comparing 1997 to 1996. 7.8% decrease on the index total, which the index crimes are generally the more serious crimes. Bad news is that there is an increase in juvenile arrested for forcible rape, and also an increase in juveniles that are weapons violations. These are raw numbers. These aren't rates or percentages. These are raw numbers, and clearly if there are more youth in Oregon, then these numbers are going to go up. Looking at them over time, which we do on page 7, you can see that although we're very excited about the decrease in 1997, it was the first time we had a decrease all the way back since 1991, and in fact, all the way back to 1985. So we were in a 10 to 12 year climb with juvenile arrests in Oregon. Just now, are we seeing it going in the downward direction?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Minnis.
What do you attribute that to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, I wish we could tell you exactly what there was an individual cause, but I think it's a combination of things. I think that the law enforcement community will tell you that they're doing a better job of community policing and a better job of focusing on youth gang activities, particularly in the urban areas. I think the district attorneys will tell you that, in part, having Measure 11 as a tool to use is making a difference. I think that we will tell you that having doubled our bed capacity these last 2 years has taken a good 500 very criminally active youth out of circulation, and that has to have an effect on these numbers. I think the prevention efforts that you'll hear about from the Commission on Children and Families and from other social agencies are all having an effect. I think there's some good laws that have been passed at local communities, curfew laws, truancy laws, the parental responsibility laws. I think all those things that Oregon communities have been doing over the last 3 or 4 years are helping us. So I think it's just I wish we could tell which of those things was making the difference so that's where we could focus our resources.
Thank you.
Oh. Please proceed, Rick.
These numbers are still pretty high, and although it's going down, we know that we're in the property offender category. One study shows Oregon as being 74% higher than the national average in juvenile property arrests. We still have a ways to go, and that's one of the reasons the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership program is so important to us. Page 8, then, we move to perhaps the single most important impact on our budget, the major impact on our budget, and that is the bed forecast that is done by Department of Administrative Services. Last month, I think on March 31st, you heard a presentation from Suzanne Porter of the Office of Economic Analysis. She went through the bed forecast for both Oregon Youth Authority and Department of Corrections. So I won't repeat that methodology for you. The bottom line is that in the governor's revised recommended budget, it does follow the April bed forecast, the new bed forecast, but it also counts on the passage of House Bill 2206, which is our bill to enact a second look for 15, 16, 17-year-olds in our system who are in on Measure 11. And so those two things combine to bring us up to a need by the end of next biennium to 1,144 beds, according to the new forecast. If the second look bill does not pass, 2206 or something like 2206 does not pass, then we believe we need another 59 beds on this chart. So that would bring our goal up to 1,203 beds. So that's important. It's important for us that House Bill 2206 pass.
Sure. Representative Kozanski.
And what would be the dollar factor if we did not have 2206 or a similar bill passed for 59?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stansky, we calculate that at $3.9 million. I want to say that that's a little bit better than a guess. I mean, we don't know how the DAs or the judges will react to the second look opportunities. face these kids. We can speculate to what percentage of them would get released and which ones wouldn't, but we had to do some guessing to get to that number. But 59 beds on average over the biennium adds up to $3.9 million. We don't know if we get to the 59 beds.
3.9 to 3.4. 3.9. 59 beds, if second location pass. 3.9 million. Okay.
On page 9, the final important factor that impacts our budget profile, in other words, kids themselves come into our system, what do they look like, what are their issues, you know, what's it going to take to turn them around. And I can describe them in a couple of different ways. First of all, they are a hardened bunch of kids. At least 3% of them are in on a murder charge or some kind of homicide-related charge, an attempted murder, attempted homicide, manslaughter, something like that. Almost one of three is a sex offender. 14% of them are in for robbery. 19% are in for some kind of an assault. And they don't just come in for one crime. The average is 2.7 adjudicated offenses upon commitment, and that does not include all the other offenses that they may have in their juvenile history before they come to us. 27% have prior weapons adjudication, so these are the youth that are out there using guns and knives, and 1 out of 5 has some affiliation with a juvenile gang. However, I can describe exactly the same kids differently. They have very difficult backgrounds as well. 78% of them are either habitual or abusive users of drugs or alcohol, that is primarily alcohol or marijuana. 45% of them have some kind of a diagnosed mental health issue. 31% have some kind of past suicide behavior. 37% of these kids have a parent or parents who has been convicted of a crime. 22% have been sexually abused themselves. 60% have and are eligible for special education. They have learning disabilities and they're on IEPs. 36% have a history of self-abuse. 31% are already parents themselves. The girls at our Hillcrest facility, many of them have babies at home. Also, a lot of the boys at McLaren and the other facilities have fathered children. Some of them claim them, some of them don't.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Nancy. I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. We're saying 1 out of 3 is either a parent to a child, or almost.
Chair, Representative Zomsky, that's correct.
Thank you.
I think to follow up on that, the importance of the debate that you hear going on about where to put prevention monies and early end or later end, it's often the same group of people. It's the delinquent kids who have the babies themselves.
Representative Zomsky, several years ago when I was a superintendent at McLaren, we did a parenting class for boys there, and it was voluntary, and we were amazed at how many boys showed up for that. That one 16-year-old I remember had already fathered 7 children by 7 different girls. So it's a huge problem, and you know, it's not something that traditionally we have addressed in the juvenile correction system. So looking at these kids two different ways, the hardened way and then looking at their backgrounds, is exactly why our mission statement needs to be a balance of public safety, accountability, reformation, and prevention. On page 10, there are 3 different ways that youth come into our custody, 3 different avenues through court. First, and the most traditional, is that of juvenile court. And as you can see by this table, breaks it down by county, most kids come to us the old-fashioned way. They come to us through juvenile court. However, we also get youth to come to us via Measure 11 in adult court, and we have kids who come to us through adult court but are waived either waived up from juvenile court to adult court for a serious A or B felony, or they start on a Measure 11 charge and then are able to negotiate that down to a lesser charge out of Measure 11, but still a waivable adult offense. So those are the numbers. On a snapshot, January 1, 1999, we had 810 in from juvenile court, 108 in on waived case, and 164 Measure 11 kids. So that's the breakdown. And you can see by county how that varies. And when Measure 11 passed in 1994, that marked the first time ever that we had youth in the juvenile corrections institutions that were in on determinate sentences. Up until that point, everything was indeterminate. And today, all the juveniles that come from juvenile court are still in on indeterminate sentences. The district attorneys are exercising discretion in the use of Measure 11 all across the state. Not every kid that does a Measure 11 crime gets charged with a Measure 11 offense. And that varies from DA to DA, from county to county.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Posansky.
Again, for clarification, we're talking 164 for true Measure 11 offenses, not Measure 11 related offenses.
That is correct. And I would add, Mr. Smoutsky, that's just a state one-day snapshot. And we move about a third of the Measure 11 kids on to the Department of Corrections. We've had many more come into our system. Some of them don't work out, and we don't spend a lot of time with them if they're unruly or uncooperative. They are in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections and physical custody of the Youth Authority. We can transfer that physical custody back to the Department of Corrections.
Rick, along those lines, you say here, your fifth bullet point, I guess, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah, OIA may keep these youth until their 21st or 25th birthday, but may transfer back to DOC those who are dangerous or do not apply themselves. How many of you have over kids over 18 years old, and, you know, what percent have you quote shipped back to DOC?
Mr. Chair, you get that exact number for you here in a second. Generally, 35% that come into our custody, 35-40%. We'll give everybody a try, but there's a segment of them that move on. They're not going to work out. They don't want to be there. They don't want to do, quote, kiddie time, as they say. They misbehave. They assault other kids. They assault the staff. They try to escape. We move those on to the Department of Corrections.
And that's roughly 35?
Yeah.
30-35.
We can get that for you. We'll get that for you in a few minutes. I think we have some other information.
The following patient, thank you.
Yeah. Your staff is back there furiously flipping.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's well. We'll get there. We'll get there.
Okay. Over 21 or over 18?
Actually over 18.
Yeah. Well, of the Measure 11 kids we've got that are in there right now, we got 37 18-year-olds, 33 19-year-olds, 21 20-year-olds, and 5 21-year-olds. So they begin to, and we'll get to that in a couple of pages.
Yeah. Okay, no problem.
Further information about Measure 11 use on page 11. You can see the breakdown of this criminal offense. And robbery is the crime of choice of most Measure 11 kids. With sex-related crimes and assault coming in close second and third. A further breakdown of the robbery cases shows that two-thirds of those are robbery in the second degree. And likewise, about two-thirds of the assault cases are assault in the second degree. The importance, I think, of pointing this out is that these are the kids that we think would be successful in a second look hearing. And there are a lot of them. So we think we could achieve that 59 dead reduction if that law were to pass.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Minnis.
For lay people, would you describe the difference between assault 1 and assault 2 and robbery 1 and robbery 2?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, I can try, perhaps with some help from some of those who practice prosecutor's role. But assault one is a very serious assault, involves a weapon, involves an intent to hurt somebody, usually there's permanent or very serious physical injury to the other person. Usually it's a weapon, an arm, a gun, a knife, a club with, you know, with some injury. An assault two can be much less than that. It can be less of an injury, less of an attack, can be less of a weapon, I guess. The classic example that was used during the debate on Measure 11 is that two kids bully up to a third kid and just push him and take his jacket. That's an assault too, or could be an assault too. Just because there's two of them, I don't think you need a weapon for that. So that's an extreme example of an assault too. But each case is different, and the DAs, again, use discretion. They look at the prior histories of these kids and what exactly were the circumstances before they make those decisions.
Is that the same, Rick? I mean, functionally for rape one and two, I mean, with a weapon, without?
Mr. Chair, the sexual offenses they're different.
Okay.
They're totally different. Because you get into all that issue about age difference and statutory rape versus other rape. That's definitely more complicated.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recall that last session we passed a very limited second look piece of legislation. Could you kind of refresh us on what that did, what impact it's had on your bids, and what this new legislation, how it would be different or how much farther it would go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, legislation last session, I believe you're referring to the Senate Bill 1049,
yes.
which wasn't truly a second look, but what it did was allow the DA at the front end to not charge every robbery two and assault two and kidnapping two with that crime. If there were conditions were such that there wasn't great harm done to the victim, then they would not fall into Measure 11. They would still be in adult court, and if convicted, the offender would get the sentencing guideline sentence rather than the Measure 11 sentence. But the difference with this session, House Bill 2206, is that we would go back and get 164 kids who are in on those Measure 11 sentences. They've done 2.5, 3 years, and it would bring them back to court for the judge to reassess them and ask the question, how have you done? Are you still a danger to the community? Or, you know, what have you done for yourself? Have you finished high school? Do you have some job skills? Have you made peace with your victim? Have you worked through your issues? Are you more mature now? Do you still have to have you incarcerated for 2.5, 3 more years, or can we transition you out? So that's the second look hearing, and we tried to do that in 97 and couldn't get a hearing for the bill.
Page procedure.
On page 12,
was that a question?
The only thing else I would say is on the 1049, it basically allowed a judge to deviate from a Measure 11 sentence if certain criteria, the DA had to agree to this type of sentencing. At the higher threshold, as here you have basically the youth coming back and demonstrating what they have accomplished during their first 3 years of incarceration to the judge, and then the judge will make that determination.
Thank you.
And then it's my understanding 1049 has been working very well.
It's hard for me to say. I mean, I do believe that it's given the discretion or some discretion back to the courts in those specific cases that it applies to, which are the second degree rob, assault, and kidnapping. I believe it's through there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chen.
For the district attorney. District attorneys exercise discretion in determining charging offense and plea negotiations. And I know when we mentioned this, how it has changed. Does that give you quite a bit of leeway, evidently, in this process also?
I'd say there's some
fairly substantial leeway whenever a prosecutor chooses to prosecute in terms of what they're willing to plead guilty to or not. That was part of the issue. That's part of the issue that Measure 40 dealt with last time, too, in terms of the victim's rights. So there's, you know, I think that that's part of the reason for that the people came out in support of Measure 11 was that they thought the judges had too much discretion at that point, and then you took the prosecutors, and, you know, at some point you have to look whether, you know, does every peg fit in a square hole.
But has it had an effect on the census?
I would think it does. I guess the way I would say, we have 36 different counties, so you have 36 different individuals that have the wide range of discretion on how to charge. And what you've seen, I think the discrepancy, though, is in a county such as Multnomah, they could have a Measure 11 charge. In fact, will charge with a Measure 11. But what they will do is they'll get the youth to agree to a lesser charge, which is known as a ballot measure-related offense, and also agree to waive themselves into the Department of Corrections. And so in Multnomah County, you'll have some youth going in for a shorter period of time than what they get for a Measure 11, but they've given up certain other rights to get this negotiation. Where in other counties, they may, on the front end, just charge them, or they will charge them with a Measure 11, but they will have them just paid out without these other caveats or stipulations. So, it's interesting, and I think the department can really give us a little bit more insight of how it has actually been applied across the state. I would just say it's not as uniform because you have 36 different people of philosophies that can be entering into the process.
We're a long ways from passing the second look, too, so we are getting some benefit in the process that we didn't know would be there when we started.
Yeah, I guess since I've been a pretty big advocate for a second look or a blended sentencing type of approach where you actually put the youth on notice at the very beginning, here's a carrot sentence, here's a six sentence. You do your carrot sentence and you then come back to the court and you demonstrate that you've done everything, then the court would have that ability, which some people would call the second look, to say, you've done well, we're going to move you into another area. And we've looked at other states that have had these programs many more years than we've actually had Measure 11 as to trying to get some type of blend. But truly, whatever we come up with, if anything, this system or whatever, has to be true for Oregon's needs as compared to some other states.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question to Rick. The $4 million, now that is determined by the census people in regards that it would save us $4 million if we got the second look?
Mr. Chair, Senator Timms, we determined that amount based on what it cost us to operate those 59 beds on average over 2 years. How we got to the 59, again, was less than scientific, and we're going to be upfront about that. We're speculating that about half of the kids, of the total kids committed to us for Measure 11, would get out on a second look. And that's based on some experience with the limited use of the second look now with non-Measure 11 kids. But we don't know until this plays out what the judges and DAs will do. It's just speculation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sorry, it's a soft number. If I could follow up, I didn't answer the last part of your question, Senator Burdick. And has 1049 affected our intake? No, it has not. We have consistently received between 12 and 13 youth on Measure 11 / waivered adult court commitment since 1995, and that did not change with the passage of 1049. So if it's working out there, we're not seeing the results on our end. It may be working more with adult offenders than with juveniles.
That's true. What's the youngest person you have currently in confinement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, probably 12. We are able to take kids after their 12th birthday. So,
what happens before 12?
Before 12, they have to be held in a secure, if they meet the level of security we provide, they would have to be held in a secure private residential center. There are two or three of them around the state, or the state hospital could hold the youth if there was a mental health issue. But We do not take kids until the 12th birthday.
The young boy down at Springfield that shot his parents and fellow students, is he going to wind up in Oregon Youth Authority or adult court as a potential incarcerated out of the penitentiary?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, he will go through adult court. He's already been determined by the district attorney in Lane County. He's being currently held in the Lane County Jail. He was held in the Lane County Juvenile Department or Juvenile Hall. As soon as he turned 16, they moved into the Lane County Jail. Trial has been postponed. He'll be probably the fall before he has a trial. So that would make him 16 going on 17. He will, if convicted, he could go to the Department of Corrections, and from there he would be transferred to us, where we would make that determination: do we keep him or do we send him back to DOC? We can keep him up to age 25, at which point we would move him back to DOC, or we could move him directly back to DOC. It would all depend on the individual assessment of his manageability and you know, where we go from here. There's also the option that he could end up in the mental health system somewhere, which would take him out of our system.
Do you have any statistics? I know, looking here at the youth population, to show what the recidivism is? What's the recidivism percentage approximately?
I do, Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon. We're going to get into that a little bit later.
Okay.
I can deal with it now or wait.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
And the other question I'd like to ask is dealing with, recently I went out on my own to tour the state penitentiary and asked for the segregation unit. And there was an amazing amount of 16, 17-year-olds that are incarcerated in the penitentiary and the segregation unit out there. My question is, has Youth Authority been in existence to have a proven track record, or are we a minor farm team for the major leagues?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, let me answer that a couple of ways. First of all, we know that there are about 30 or 35 juveniles in the adult correction system right now, underage kids, 16, 17, underage 18. That's all there are. It does not surprise me, though, that a lot of them are in segregation. It's very difficult kids to manage. That's why they're there. I mean, we manage them quite differently than the Department of Corrections does. And when you get Dave Cook up here, he'll tell you that the kids that come from our system to their system are a handful. They are not yet ready to do adult time. They don't understand how to do jail time. They're still acting out. They're still seeking attention. They're still hyperactive. They're angry. They don't want to be there. And they have not yet matured to the point where they can just do their time. So they're a handful. And in other states where they have also passed Measure 11-like mandatory sentences, they've not had those kids come to their youth corrections agency. They've had them go into adult correction. And they've had their hands full. They've had to build special units for them. They've had to provide additional treatment, additional education, additional counseling, and end up costing themselves right back to the youth authority side. So it's a challenging population. The second part of the question, do we have a track record and are we just preparing kids for prison? I am going to go to the board and get the recidivism chart because I think it's the right way to answer that question.
Well, Rick has been at, I will say that those 30 or so kids that are with Department of Corrections did generally almost all start with us, and for the very reasons that Rick mentioned, they are not ready to go to school or quit helping either the staff or their peers, and that's why we sent them to the Department of Corrections.
Well, that's what blew me away, Mr. Chairman, was going out to penitentiary and seeing the segregation when about 30 of these teenagers, 16, 17, are locked up in the segregation unit. And I mean, that's pretty heavy duty for a 16 or 17-year-old, but as they said out there, they're out of control. So
some of those youth have said that they want to do hard time with the big boys. And
okay.
Recidivism is measured a lot of different ways over a period of time. And, you know, what is the trigger that causes to count them as a recidivist, and what is the time with which we measure that? And this is a chart. We've been doing this now for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 biennia. So do we have a track record? Well, even before we were the youth authority, when we were juvenile corrections within the Department of Human Resources, we started tracking our recidivism by this particular measure, which is what percentage of the youth return to our custody after the release, after their first release. And as you can see, what happens is a lot of them, if they're going to come back, they come back within the first month, second month, third month, fourth month. The first 6 months to 12-month period, it increases, it shoots up, and then it levels off. So if they're going to come back, it's going to come back during that first year. So the statistic we use at the 12-month point is 1 year. What percentage of kids come back to us within 1 year? The answer is that each of these biennia that go by, we're getting better and better and better.
Tell us what page that's on.
It's in the performance measure.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It's under tab 6 in the back.
Mr. Chair, if I could also throw out another question.
Rick, could you also address regarding the recidivism? Because you're taking a snapshot of basically kids for a three-year period or thereabouts. And then once they reach of age for adults, they could be recidivism into the DOC or adult court where you would not see them. Have y'all done any tracking on that?
We do try to track kids that end up in DOC, and we have those numbers. The problem with those numbers is that since MAC 11 passed, all those kids, or a lot of our kids, already are in touch with DOC, so it's washed away our objective sample.
Right.
But what we found was that only about 1 in 5 of the kids that we had released, even as many as 8 years later, 1 in 5 actually end up in the hard part of DOC, in the independent center or OSCI. A much higher percentage get into trouble, do some little stuff, and maybe end up on adult probation, or work release or something, but it's about 1 in 5 and actually end up going on to the state penitentiary. So we're improving each session. In fact, this last 2 years, or this last 1 year, is the lowest, significantly lower than it has been in the past. And that is in your books. We found it here.
Under tab 10.
Tab 10, performance measure 1. So a close-up of that, as well as some data, the data points that relate to that.
Mr. Chair. Representative Patridge.
As we're talking a little bit about second look and other things in regards to Measure 11, I think many of the proponents of Measure 11 would argue that that there is some deterrent effect that goes along with Measure 11 in regards to the crime, and I was looking at your statistics comparing. I lost them again on page 6. Crimes against persons, which are the Measure 11 crimes, and those have fallen by 7.6%, and close to, which is more than your other areas, not by much, arguably, but over your average of 4.2%. I guess my question is, from your vantage point, or do you see it as part of what you do? There's a bill in that Representative Atkinson is the sponsor of this time, which is his 1020 life bill in regards to gun crimes, which is similar to the program that California has offered up. But part of that bill, and a significant portion of that bill, there's money that's appropriated that would go towards advertising, targeting the advertising, so that kids would be aware and you hopefully would have more deterrent effects because that is out there. What does the Youth Authority do in terms of those types of programs and
can you, or do you view that as your role in terms of the scared straight kind of approach? As someone who's a prosecutor, I was, when Measure 11 passed and all that, I was a little wary, but as I was walking along the street one day with a police officer who was plainclothes, someone who, we've had tons of problems with in Medford, came by and we hadn't seen him in the system for a couple of years, and he said, hello, and how are things going? Nice to see you. He said, boy, this is a lieutenant. He said, I haven't seen you in a while. He said, well, yeah, with this Measure 11 thing going on, I don't want to go to jail anymore. I'm getting too old, and I don't want to do this anymore. And this guy was like 20 years old. And so, to me, that was, that had a very significant impact on me in terms of the scared straight kind of approach. I'm just wondering how the youth authority is approaching that, or what you're doing to be proactive.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, first of all, I think there is a deterrent effect with the passage of Measure 11, but I think it's about what we've got, 5, 6, 7%. I still think that 93, 94% of the kids they could care less what the penalty is. They're not going to get caught. We participated in the production of 3 videos since Measure 11. One in association with the Association of Oregon Industry, the other with the Attorney General, and the third one with a youth group in Multnomah County of probationers who did working with the Northwest Film Center that did a very good Measure 11 presentation. And we've reproduced that in Spanish. And we're trying to get those out to all the junior high schools, middle schools, and high schools all around the state. And in fact, we should probably bring one in and show it here during maybe next week or later this week to give you a flavor how we're different ways we try to reach kids. The realities are harsh, and a lot of times kids that are on the fringes, these at-risk kids, they don't listen to authority anyway, but they will listen to each other. So I think the video of having the youth present the realities of Measure 11 is the most effective one. It's the one we get the most requests for. We'd like to do a lot more of that, but it's not, it's not cheap to produce those things. But
then as a follow-up, is there any money in your budget to do any kind of advertising for those kinds of things? 30-second TV spots, any of those kinds, because I know that's like the approach California and some of the other states have really taken, and they've seen arguably some substantial decreases.
Mr. Chair and Representative Patrick, we do have a brochure called One Strike and You're Out that we try to get into all the school districts, and our parole and probation officers work often in the school districts and provide that information. I think a lot of it, though, is maturation. It's a person who's been engaging in crime and reaches age 20 all across the country, that's an age level where it begins to make sense to them that another way of life is preferable. A 15-year-old who does one of these serious crimes generally doesn't stop and think. So part of it is just a maturity.
Mr. Chair, before I move on, actually my voice is given out and I will let Karen talk, but before I do that, I want to go back because I mistakenly forgot to fail to introduce Mr. McGee, who is going to start this presentation with his overview. So I think maybe we'll do that now. I'm sorry, Bill.
According to our schedule, you're going to start.
Well,
we follow the rules, right?
Bill, Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. I'll work off the regular handout that you've seen before and all of the budget. The governor's revised budget for the Oregon Youth Authority is $207.3 million general fund, which is 15.8% above the $97 million legislative approved budget. The revised $252.2 million total funds is a 18.8% increase from the legislative budget. The major parts of the budget are the incorporation, as Rick indicated, of the economic analysis, juvenile correction population forecast. It
You heard from Ms. Porter several weeks ago. This is really the first time you'll see a budget for youth authority that does have that forecast of its basis, and there'll be some things we'll be asking you to approve in order to establish that as how they forecast beds. Second item is the reduction in beds based on the second look legislation that's been filed. We'll talk to you about that one too. The third, this budget has $10 million of the governor's $30 million juvenile crime prevention partnership, and we'll have Steve Marks and some other folks in to talk to you in detail about that next week. The budget maintains programs and services to adjudicated youth, and it captures some program efficiencies and administrative reductions as well. Quickly capturing, taking you through the development of the budget, the 97-99 adopted budget was $171.6 million general fund and $195.7 million total fund, and just under 1,200 full-time equivalent positions. Several emergency board actions during the last interim, the salary adjustment course for all agencies. The Deschutes County Delinquent Youth Demonstration Project begun with initial funding approved by the emergency board at several different points during the interim. As Rick indicated, the emergency board also approved the debt service and initial funding for the Juvenile Justice Information System to begin that project. There were funds provided for the department's suicide prevention program following the suicide hookup, and federal grant funds were received for the boot camp in Eastern Oregon, which as Rick indicated is under construction now. There were a number of current service level budget adjustments, again, the usual position and inflationary cost changes that you see in all budgets. There are costs to phase in, to fully biannualize the cost of operation for the five new regional facilities throughout the state, two boot camps, and the suicide prevention program. The current service level includes population changes through the October 1998 forecast. The governor's revised budget will take you through the April 99 forecast that you heard from Chief Porter a couple weeks ago. There is a second biennium funding for JGIS development and operations as they move forward to begin to complete that project. We will fully phase in the Deschutes County Delinquent Youth Demonstration Project for the full biennium. There are foster care caseload and staff increases in current service level. Adjustments to reflect current federal funding levels and Medicaid funding, those are changing current service levels traditionally for agencies that receive those dollars. We've established an overtime temporary employee and differential budget for the existing boot camp. The lack of doing that was an oversight in prior budgets, so we're fixing that error. And finally, there are adjustments to the diversion program funding and provider payments that also correct errors from the 97-99 budget. Takes the current service level. There are 11 policy packages. Rather than go through all of those today, I'll do what I've done in the past and come back before each of the program units and go through the packages in detail. But the governor's budget, the packages that were included at that time, did have $5.6 million in general fund and just under $22 million total funds, and reduced positions by 13 and FTE by 22.01. The substance of those packages were to reduce beds by 5% based on the second look for 59 beds worth of admissions, to include the $10 million in juvenile crime prevention partnerships, to fund growth in discretionary beds projected in the Office of Economic Forecasts. Because this is the first time you will approve the forecast as part of the agency's budget, we have to make some adjustments. The 1995 legislature approved 100 beds for the discretionary kids, the ones who took time from the juvenile court system. We're asking you to fund those, the growth in that, so that that growth will be reflected in the agency's current service level and future biennium. There was a package for increased staff training, which was eliminated in the governor's revised budget, and a package to fund mental health assessments for at-risk youth, which is also eliminated in the governor's revised budget. The governor's budget continues the Minority Youth Transition Program after the expiration of federal grants, reduces services, supplies, and facilities and administration divisions based on some efficiencies in operations. It increases funds for capital improvement to address the agency's $7.2 million deferred maintenance backlog, and it implements a behavioral rehabilitation services model for residential care, which allows us to increase payments to residential care providers and significantly increases the use of federal funds in the budget. So that takes us through the governor's recommended, if I could now finish taking us through the governor's revised budget and the various technical adjustments. The governor's revised budget will fund the closed custody population increased forecast that was issued in April 99. As I said, it eliminates the policy packages for mental health assessments and for staff training.
It equalizes the rate increases for residential treatment providers with that offered by the State Office for Service and Children and Families and DHR, and shifts to a fund for, a fee for services reimbursement model. So we're only paying for residential care beds when we actually have a kid in the bed. Four administrative positions are eliminated and service and supplies are reduced in the agency. We're increasing the other fund's expenditure limitation for JGIS. There will be increased carryover of COP dollars. The policy package for increased capital improvement is being shifted to other funds to be supported with other revenues, and we're asking you to transfer some of the limitation to a capital construction limitation to allow the agency to begin planning to replace its administration building in McLaren, which is in bad condition currently. We're able to shift some facilities costs from general fund to other funds based on a revised estimate of how much the Department of Ed will be able to provide to OIA for student nutrition program that's financed by the federal government. We've got an error in personal services costs for the facility staff that we're correcting. We're capturing the savings in the Attorney General costs and the reductions we took in their budget earlier. We're establishing another fund's expenditure limitation for canteen and work program sales. That's an ongoing program, but we haven't had a limitation for it before. And we're funding a new COP management assessment from the state treasurer for their operations and managing that. The impact of all these adjustments is to reduce the general fund from the governor's recommended to the revised by $3.7 million, decrease total funds by $1.7 million, and eliminate a position at almost a full FTE. Quickly, what's been missing is in this budget from the prior biennium, or the current biennium actually, is the reduction in forecast beds, anticipation second look, some efficiencies in support services in McLaren and Hillcrest to generate some savings, reduction in administration positions and services and supplies, efficiencies in the pro and probation for the implementation of the risk basis assessment system that the agency will be talking to you shortly about, and some reductions in the foster care caseload. In terms of new programs, the agency is part of the governor's Bureau of Crime Prevention, as we said, $10 million or $30 million.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions for Mr. McGee?
Sure.
Senator Hans.
Bill, looking on page 4 of your analysis, the $3 million is being reduced on general fund in the governor's revised budget. What does that translate into bed space?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, the $3.7 million does not eliminate any of the closed custody beds in the agency. We've taken all those reductions from other parts of the budget. In fact, we'll fund and increase 14 beds through that reduction to deal with the April 19th. So we're eliminating some policy packages in the programs area. We're cutting some positions and service supplies, but we are maintaining all the beds.
Where does this budget take us versus what the forecast calls for?
Mr. Chair, this budget fully funds the forecast with the reduction, except for the reduction in beds based on the second look hearing. So we're funding all except those.
So there will be some empty beds because of the second look hearing.
The governor's budget reduces the budget by $4 million roughly based on that. So we're essentially eliminating the beds, but not growing the beds. I'm not sure if there'll be physically empty beds. Rick's correcting me. It's actually a reduction in the growth in beds.
Okay. And then the other question I have is federal funds. It shows a deletion of 492. Was that grant money or was that program operation grant federal funds?
Let's let staff address this. I think she has some.
Okay.
Back to your previous question on the number of beds and the capacity. In fact, what happens at either the governor's recommended or the governor's revised level is with the assumption of the 59-bed reduction, OIA then will not need to add additional capacity during 1999-01 or bills early in 01-03. But if the budget indeed covers the full forecast, they would be looking at having to add dead capacity early in 01-03. So it's not a question of empty dead space so much as not having to build more.
Okay. Okay.
To hand add to your question, the 400,000 that we got based on the fee-for-service model that's being used for residential care providers. In the past, the agency has contracted for a certain number of beds through the biennium. Next biennium, they will actually pay for only the beds that they use as they go along, so that's providing a reduction there in that.
Well, let me ask you on that, and maybe Karen is the person to inquire. What is this due to programs like Aspen and Lithia Springs, where they have the girls and young men that are not technically incarceration, but they're kind of released back out to a community treatment base? What does this reduction in federal funds mean for something like that? Anything?
No, it does not result in a reduction to those programs. We have changed federal funding sources, moving away from subsidies through more traditional foster care, and into a different kind of federal subsidy that actually does a number of things. It provides more funds to the local providers. It also requires them to provide more services to the youth. And Bill might want to... moving in that direction, we've also followed the mandates of Senate Bill 1, which requires us to only pay for services that we're receiving. Up until this time, providers such as the ones you've mentioned have gotten a contract with the youth authority, and they've received 12 equal monthly payments, whether or not their beds are full. This allows us and requires them to receive payment only for the services that they're providing. We don't believe that they will be able or will likely be able to operate at 100% capacity, just because of the nature of moving kids in and moving kids out. We don't know if that's the case or not.
How much, based upon that figure that it says you get X amount of dollars to run a program, and now you're going fee for service in this actual bed space, and you already indicate they might not be the capacity, then what is the net effect potentially to those community-based programs?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hannon, I could go back and look and try to come up with some estimates on that. In the overall picture, however, those providers will be receiving more money than they did in the past because of the new funding system. They will also be required to provide more services, but generally the providers are very supportive of this because we are able to increase their rate of pay.
Okay, now the other thing.
Well, we are showing a reduction in federal funding of $400,000 in the governor's revised budget, and the governor's recommended shows an increase of over $17 million in federal funds because we've gone to the new model of reimbursement. So the residential care providers have all gotten pretty significant rate increases.
So the actual new model caused the creation of additional federal funds?
Substantially, yes. The fee-for-service saved us a little bit of money, but overall we've increased very substantially because of going to this new market.
Okay. The other thing I want to ask you, I think you know where this is going to be about year-round education. Youth in your facility, do you provide them year-round education?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hannon, the Department of Education contracts with local school districts to provide those services. They are year-round. However, they receive funding based on a rather standard school year, and rather than taking a large portion of the summer off, they take shorter breaks throughout the year and do provide summer sessions. But because of the closed custody nature of those programs, they are able to set a different school
program?
That's part of our problem in the youth program there in Ashland, is the fact that it has a contract with the local school district for 9 months, and the other 3 months the kids just sit around, and they don't get to educate them. Well, they can educate them, but it's very costly. But I'd like to visit with you on that and see where we could maybe help make a difference.
This
used to work in the Department of Education. Maybe I would change the attitude now you left over.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannah, no. Same attitude, and I agree with you that it's a problem, and
yeah.
I think there may be some creative ways to get those two things together.
Yeah, thank
is
you.
Is that because of the contract? I don't think the one in Burns, is that a year-round system because it's a nurse?
Senator Timms, I believe that it is. It may not have exactly...
We changed the contract then to get it to a year-round.
Yes.
Right?
That's my understanding.
And yeah, that makes sense because those jobs are...
It's a little...
But it's a good job.
It's quite a bit different in a closed custody situation where when the school's not in session, the kids stay on the cottage and are under the supervision of the youth authority staff rather than just being turned out on the street.
I'm on vacation.
Oh,
sure. Well, sure. Yes.
I guess my from what I gathered, Senate Bill 1 has shifted, you've shifted on Senate Bill 1 from a fee-for-service to a flat fee. You shifted from a flat fee to a fee-for-service on these OYA beds that are in the local communities. And you've said that you've increased the rate, but you're only using them a certain number of days. So overall, they make more money? There's more money that's available?
Mr. Chair and Representative Patridge, overall, there's significantly more money available due to the influx of the federal funding. They're required to do more to get that money. They're generally happy with that. There are things that everybody's wanted to do for these youth. We're able to do that with the federal subsidy. And so the going from the flat 12 months to the fee-for-service, we believe that in the end, this will actually provide more stability for the providers than in the past.
Well, I guess my concern for some of my local providers is that now they're not, before they were kind of getting a stabilized fund so they could complete their whole budget cycle. Like we had Community Works there in Southern Oregon that will have some fluctuations because it's on a fee-for-service basis now rather than kind of a flat line basis that they had before. So my concern is, do we have other agencies like Community Works statewide that may have some trouble balancing their own budget because they were balancing based upon a continued stream of payments by the state of Oregon? And is there a possibility that we're going to lose off some of these agencies because they're already fairly thin anyway? We're going to lose some of these agencies and not have beds available in my community or others on a statewide basis because they're not able to budget and it's just a fee-for-service basis.
Mr. Chair and Representative Patridge, this represents about a 97% occupancy rate, if you will. One of the problems that the state had with the 12 equal payments is there was no incentive for those providers to keep the beds full. That's the same amount of money whether they had running at capacity or not. They will receive full funding if they remain at capacity. And if we're wrong on the 97% capacity, unfortunately, we'll be back in front of the emergency board saying that we have kids in those beds that need to be paid for. This was an attempt to imagine that statewide there's going to be a 3% bed vacancy spread across the state at any given time.
Mr. Chair, I guess my concern is to me this is kind of like privatizing prisons but not insuring I just have some concerns that this is like privatizing prisons and not ensuring some kind of threshold level. And I've toured some of these facilities, and they're not lush accommodations or anything else. They're barely, a lot of these, where some of these youth authority beds are that aren't facilities are, you know, are with community service kinds of agencies that budget on very thin budgets. And my concern is, you know, I'm willing to wait and see what happens, but, you know, I'm concerned, and maybe, you know, I'd like to see something in the narrative so we can address what the impact of this has been on our local communities. Because I don't know how local, those local beds could incentive, how they can't just go out and capture kids, I guess, and say, you've got to stay here. I find that interesting.
Mr. Chair and Representative Petters, the rather thin budgets that they've been operating on, and some of them, you're right about that. That, however, was before we went to the new model. So overall, they will be getting more money than they currently have, which we believe will help stabilize them. I think, and our concern, but we think it will kind of turn out in the wash, is that it may not be the financial problems that these small providers face, but they may not be able to provide the level of service required in order to get the federal funding. It's going to cause them to have to do more to get more money.
Okay, then as an additional question, if we're trying to incentivize them to do a better job, or provide these additional services, how do you decide where the youth beds are going to be put? Like, for example, we have HD Center who have the ability, like community work, who want two additional beds because they feel like that's what they need to stabilize the funding cycle. So instead of providing the two OYA beds, I think they want four OYA beds. And, you know, how do you determine if on one hand you just said you want to incentivize them to do a good job, and how are we going to reward them on the backside of them?
I think, President Patrick, what we'll see over time with this new model is that some providers will go out of business. Some will not be able to survive, and others will flourish. And those that are going to flourish are going to pick up those extra beds from those that fall by the wayside. This does change the landscape. This goes from a guaranteed contract to you've got to earn it. And you've got to stay full, and you've got to take the kids that are out there for you. And this does create some competition. This became law in 1995, with Senate Bill 1. It has taken us 3 years to implement this, and what we were waiting for was a way to make it work. And with the BRS, with the new money, we can now make this work. And it will create competition, no question about that.
The problem that we've had as an agency before this is very difficult kids, which is what I'm about to talk about, have paying providers, but providers unwilling to take those very difficult kids and still receiving payments. So what we're trying to do is strike a balance here by saying you will receive more for working with these very difficult kids, but you'll be required to keep the beds full under your contract in order to receive those funds. And in response, Representative Patrick, to your question about how they get the kids, the Youth Authority, like all the state governments, contracts with these private providers, usually through a request for proposal process, and we're limited by the budget. And as Rick said, if one decides to get out of the business, then we'll either enhance their contracts or go out on a new RFP process. But then it's our parole and probation officers that are continually looking for an appropriate placement around the state for a youth either coming in on parole or leaving, or coming in on probation or leaving on parole. I think when you hear in public testimony some of the providers talk, there's been no doubt a lot of anxiety about this because it is a change. For the most part, though, most of them are pleased with the change because of the new resources and the new services for the youth. Can we continue? Just to give you a little more information about the kinds of youth, I'm on page 13, and the next few pages are descriptions of the youth. Rick got into this a little bit, but when we get more in-depth into those budget on what we on facilities and community programs, I think it's helpful if you have an idea of the profiles of the youth that we serve in addition to their criminal behavior. And we have a significant number of minority youth in our system, and if you look at the chart on page 13, you can see that going from the at-risk population, which we defined as basically Oregon's teenage population, given that all of them are at risk of committing a crime, that the more serious the offense and sanction of going through juvenile courts on the juvenile offenders and adult court through the, on the bottom two pie charts, you see that there are fewer and fewer Anglo youth in the system, increasingly more minority youth, and increasing over-representation of minority youth in the system. Now, the challenges that that represents to the youth authority are that of remembering our mission of one of public safety, accountability, and youth reformation. In this overview of the services that we provide, once we've achieved some level of public safety, either through supervision or lockup in a youth correctional facility, then our challenge is to make youth accountable for their crimes and reform them so they don't continue with a life of crime. And we do that by establishing remorse or getting the youth to establish remorse for his or her acts, taking responsibility for his or her acts, and participating in reformation opportunities, which usually means developing new skills, education skills and social skills. I think it's easy to think that the kids do have other ways to behave and are just choosing not to. That's true for some youth, but some of the youth have learned successfully that these acting out behaviors have worked right up until now. And so to the extent that we have increasing representation of minority youth in order to reach them on the accountability and reformation levels, we are challenged by language barriers, cultural barriers, and not only in working with the youth, but with their families. We're very proud of our employment record of hiring and promoting and retaining minority staff, but we don't come, even though we match the state profile on that, we don't come close to meeting our population, our youth population profile. And there is increasing concern from the minority communities about the treatment and reformation that the youth are receiving and that are in the youth authority custody. A little has been mentioned already, flipping the page, about the challenges presented by female offenders. They're small in number, fewer than 10% of the population that we serve are females. They usually have a different basis for their problems and different behaviors, and generally has historically not been particularly successfully reformed or rehabilitated when lumped in with boys and to the general treatment programs. So we have a challenge with a small number of females spread over a pretty large age range to group them together in any meaningful way. Rick mentioned the conversion of Corvallis House, which you will see tomorrow, as a transition program for female offenders. We think that we've been told that's the first in the country of its type as a transition out of incarceration for young women. And we always like to say that that's cost neutral. We did that just by moving beds around. An overriding concern among our youth is the mental health needs, and this is not true just of Oregon, but is a trend we see across the country, which is an increasing incarceration of youth with significant mental health issues. I won't read you the numbers, but Oregon certainly has numbers to match the federal prevalence rates, and our firsthand experience with that. was dealing with the suicides at the Hillcrest facility last year. Clearly, the youth that we're receiving who are committing crimes have significant, more and more complex and significant mental health needs. We do try to address those needs. One of the challenges is, however, we're a correctional institution. We're not a mental hospital. We don't want to provide the best mental health services in the state because we don't want youth children to have to commit crimes in order to get mental health services. So we're always trying to establish a balance between appropriate mental health services and a correctional facility. We also have a significant number of youth who are gang affiliates. If you look at page 15, you can see that right now we have about 20 counties are sending us youth who have gang affiliates. We used to be able to better show trends from year to year, but law enforcement policies between the state police and local law enforcement have differed over whether to identify and track gang affiliates or not, so I can't provide you very good information about that. Only to point out to you that in 1992, 25% of the gang youth in our custody were from outside Multnomah County, and in 1998 that's expanded to 60%, so it's pretty much a statewide phenomenon at this point.
Mr. Chair.
What percentage of the youth in total are gang-affiliated or gang-related?
Of their incarcerations?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, we think it's about one in five, 20%. The problem recently is that more and more jurisdictions are not labeling. They're afraid to label youth as gang-affected. So we saw a drop-off immediately in kids coming in with gang designations from local jurisdictions. So we have to kind of do our own designating, and sometimes we're also a little gun shy on that. So we make sure there's a documentation in the file that there was a gang-related crime before we'll designate them.
Excuse me, Karen. The chart on page 15 indicates that there's as much gang activity, or at least as a percent of your population in Harney County, good senators district, as there is in Deschutes County. And that can't be. We got some, little hotbeds of activity over there. And
a little bit bigger than we are.
Senators, yeah, immensely growing, lots of growth, good drug markets, all that kind of stuff. You're telling me you've got one person in OIA from Deschutes County this gang-related activity.
Sure, I can probably paint a picture of why that would make some sense. As Rick said, there isn't a test we give kids to determine whether they're affiliated with gangs or not. A lot of it is what's in their criminal record and their own purported activity. Also in Deschutes County, through the pilot project, you've retained many youth in Deschutes County who probably are gang affiliated that simply haven't come to the youth authority.
Yeah, but we're not keeping those high cop guys. We're sloughing them up on you. So. Let's call it good. Okay, well, I just struck me as somewhat of an anomaly.
To go back to the female offenders, Rick is familiar with the CAP program, Plymouth Adolescent Program, in Plymouth County. Because I've been an advocate of that program, and I have reports from the last year that it's a great program, regardless of what you think of the schemes in the process. But that is a situation that is level 7 before they go, or could go into a facility. Is there any way that you can license that CAP program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tim, the Youth Authority does not have any licensing authority whatsoever. We did not carry that with us from DHR.
No, you used to have it.
We, as part of CSC, CSC would license our program. They still license our program. We do not do licensing.
So if I want to get somebody to license it,
licensing.
I have to go through TSD. Which is impossible to get a license. So I'll just do it directly.
I'll just conclude this by saying that of these problems and challenges that I've mentioned, it's not unusual for youth to have more than one, to be a female with a significant mental health need and be a minority. So they're very complex kids.
Picking up on page 16 and 17, cost per day comparisons is always an important issue. And we've done these two displays to put the cost in perspective for you. The cost per day in youth authority facilities, our secure facilities, is now going to be $138.38 a day. But that's really in the middle of the various services afforded to youth in OIA's custody. Foster care, mom and pop foster care, extending on up to a more sophisticated professional foster care, that averages at $35 a day. Our camps, youth accountability camps and work-study camps, average out to $94 a day. Then you get into some of the new BRS, Behavior Rehab Services, residential child care centers, and these are the programs that we were just talking about with Representative Patridge. These are their new rates with the new federal match. These are up to $105, $109, $116 a day for level 4, level 5 kids, which are not the same as the level 7 that we know from SCF, but these are increasingly more difficult youth to be managed, $121 a day, $143 a day. So these rates are tremendously higher than they used to be, which is what allows us to get to the fee-for-service system. Going on, if the youth needs hospitalization, the JCAHO, which means Joint Commission on Accreditation Healthcare Organizations, these are accredited hospitals, basically, for mental health issues for kids, $200, $240, $250 a day. Ultimately, the Oregon State Hospital Child Adolescent Unit is $446 a day. So, again, these youth are difficult to manage. They're expensive to manage. This is not 200 kids in a cell block with a gun power. This is youth corrections.
Hey, Bertie.
On this chart for the comparison, the $138.38 that you charge, you'd have to add the education cost.
Yes.
To get a true cost.
Correct.
Would you also add the education, when they're in the long-term treatment and even hospitalized, do they still get those education services?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, they do, and generally those are funded, again, through the Department of Education. For example, at the Oregon State Hospital, the Oregon Department of Education receives a specific budget for those youth, and they contract with the Willamette ESD to provide the educational services in the hospital setting.
So that cost is significant across the board, depending on
what the regards that Yes, the community youth care centers, the local school districts are legally responsible for the education of those youth. They can collect funds through the state school fund and then either provide those services or contract to have those services provided. So generally, they are on top of these. I would, without examining them, I would hate to tell you every single one of them is, but for the most part, they're.
Sure.
Senator Chen, do we get any federal match in these, any federal monies like we were talking to, alluding to before?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chen, yes. Foster care is matched 77% general fund.
You have some place that shows that later on.
Yeah, we can get this chart. We can get that for you tomorrow.
Okay. Just for list. Maybe I have to go through that.
Okay. I know we just have a little bit of time left, so... Mr. Chair, may give me the cue here when you want to stop.
Well, I mean, no agency or department that's come before this committee yet has gotten through their agency overview in a lot of time, so don't feel slighted and discriminated against.
We've got a very inquisitive
committee, and we're proud of them. So just go until 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock, okay. Page 17, then, is, again, a cost comparison, and this time with other states. And we've taken our number, this time $128.56, and that's a little different than the 138 because we've factored in our camps and our youth candidate camps, so it lowers the average. We come in, our what we call our close custody average, 128 a day. And you can see the other western states are either a little bit higher or a little bit lower than that. So we're not out of the ballpark. There are some states that do it for a lot less. Some of the southeastern states, Mississippi, Arkansas, Alabama. There are some big states that do it for a little bit less. California, Texas come in about $90, $95 a day. Their services are pretty much the same as ours, but they have such large numbers that in an economy of scale drives their cost per day down. So we're right about in the middle, a little bit on the lower end of the western states.
Turning to page 18, our focus, having built the new facilities and concentrated on public safety, and put more effort into, or more concentrated effort on reformation, we also want to ensure that our agency itself is accountable, and these two pages give an overview of some of the accountability measures that we use against ourselves. The agency performance measures, for example, and given the time, I won't read them. There's an appendix under tab 10 that goes through each of them, but we do try to track more than just restitution, knowing that we're dealing with youth, and the more education they have, the more skills they have, the better opportunities they have to eventually move out of the correctional system. Recidivism, Rick talked a little bit about that before. There's a summary of the state first statewide recidivism report under Appendix 3. And what we have learned from this report kind of adds to the body of knowledge that we know about young people who commit crimes. For example, about 80% of the youth who have a referral to a juvenile department never come back again. They remain crime-free. 20% of those youth go on and commit a pretty high number of crimes. They recidivate at the juvenile department level. We also know that then of those youth who come into the youth authority, again, a smaller percentage of those youth go on to commit a pretty significant amount of crime. We believe that the benefit of these kind of statistics, it's a little too soon to do this, but with the development of the juvenile justice information system and having counties all working off of the same definitions, we believe that the future benefit is if we can identify who these youth are earlier and apply different programming, different sanctions, different educational opportunities specifically to those youth who have a profile that would make us think they're going to be one of the few who commits high levels of crime, that could provide us with answers in actually reducing juvenile crime.
Mr. Senator James,
we've had drug courts in here and family law courts and those type of things. Actually, just got through with that. In the referral process, who are the major? Do you have a rundown of who are the major referrals that refer for people? Is it mainly the court system in Dallas that does that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Timms, I'm not sure if I know what you mean by referral. The youth
wants to tell you you're in trouble.
The juvenile departments respond to referrals from law enforcement. So we're talking about kids who've moved beyond level 7, kids who have committed law violations.
Okay, so then the first offense, unless it goes through the court system, and it's a juvenile offense, you don't look at it.
That's right. Unless it's a very significant offense, eventually. The youth whose first time offense.
So it would go to the Commission on Children and Families or wherever in that process where you look at at-risk kids.
Would usually at a referral from a law enforcement agency, the first offense would go to the juvenile department, your local juvenile department, that would manage that case and determine are there services in the community that they might access through the local commissions, or they might access through another agency, mental health
local school districts. But generally, if it's a low-level crime and a first offense, they don't come into the state custody.
So it seems to me if you want to get the recidivism, the sooner you get through them, the better off you are.
Mr.
The estimation on children and families or whatever, and not the juvenile process.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sims, I think everybody believes that. However, we know that most kids don't commit crimes. We know that 80% of those who do commit a crime and get referred to the general departments aren't going to come back. So what we're trying to do is get, no matter what we do, they're not going to commit another crime. One brush with the law seems to have been enough. So what we're trying to do is get better at targeting who are those youth who have a profile that would make us believe they're smart, part of this small group that continues to break the law, and then target early on those youth. But we're not that scientific yet. It's getting better.
That's great.
You heard that we underwent a three-part audit by the Secretary of State's Audit Division. I won't spend time on that, knowing that you will hear from them directly. We are also in the stages of implementing the Juvenile Justice Information System, and I was part of the group that spoke to you for 2 days about the public safety information systems, and that system, I believe, is the key to a lot of these answers that we don't have. What did these kids look like early on? What kind of treatment did they receive that worked or didn't work? And then Rick mentioned that we are part of a national project looking at performance standards in our secure facilities. We have been selected by a couple of these national agencies to implement these new standards that are performance-based across our facilities. We have worked with them to go through the first round of assessment and are in the process of developing improvement plans for each facility. We believe that those national standards actually hold a lot of promise for improving the outcomes of our youth. I feel like I'm talking really fast.
Well, if you get through your overview today, and you're the first agency to do it, and you make the chair look bad,
mm-hmm. Make sure it's good.
Yeah, that's quite all right. You're doing great,
Mr. Chair.
Are you at?
Let me tell you where we're at. Page 20 and page 21 are the adds and the reductions that were already covered by Mr. McGee in his overview.
Right.
We will go into those in more detail, section by section, as they reappear in this budget. So I could get all the way to page 24 here, not to make you look bad, Mr. Chair, but the bottom line is that is the governor's revised budget in picture form of where we're at. We're at 252 million total funds, 207 of that is general fund. You can see how it's distributed on the right. So that is the overview for OIA. We don't really have much more that we won't cover in the next few days. So that would be the summary of it.
Great. We got through the overview.
Because I wasn't here much.
That's it. And Representative Schrader wasn't here. But that's a different story.
Okay.
I really want to compliment the agency. This type of bullet point, summarized presentation, I mean, all the way through this thing, you guys have done a great job of flipping ahead. And so, compliments and kudos. I mean, that really helps us,
number one. And then secondly, I don't know who has or hasn't signed up for the tour tomorrow, but for those who haven't, I would really encourage you to spend some time with us tomorrow.
We're going to see tomorrow.
12:15. You need to see it.
Well, I've got a zoo now, so.
Yeah, but you're going to see Corvallis House. You're going to see, you know, kind of the old style, new style. You're going to see Corvallis House.
Hillcrest.
Been there.
New fence going up.
I've seen the new fence. Drove by there after I came to the golf club.
Yeah, but you haven't seen it from the inside.
Was that you looking for your golf
club? I can't hit them that far.
Sorry, I just encourage everyone to attend. We leave at 12:30 from the front. You're finding the front of the Capitol is the steps on Court Street, right? Last word.
We are adjourned. We'll see you at 12:30 tomorrow.
Good presentation.